Listener Production. Dave Hughes is one of the biggest names in Australian comedy. To be with Hughesy is to train your gaze to see the wonderful, to attend to and meditate on what you love, even in the midst of difficult realities. Seeing the world through his eyes, we understand that there is no such thing as yesterday, only here and now. Hughesy calls joy the happiness that doesn't depend on what happens. It's a choice you make regardless of what's going on around you. In this intimate conversation, we talk about his struggles with alcohol, how the words I love you are so hard to say, and why failure is not what it seems.
In your failure is the seeds of your success. Because when you can see your failure as funny, well, then you can't be defeated.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Dave Hughes is a comedian, radio, and television presenter. He is Hughesy in the Hughesy and Ed duo, one of Australia's most loved radio shows. In this episode, you will learn how to find true happiness from deep within. Dave, you grew up in Warrnambool in a commission house in Victoria, and you were one of four. You have twin sisters and an older brother. How were the childhood years for you?
Life was fun growing up, you know, although my, you know, there was a bit of drinking in the house, if I'm going to be honest. So that was, could be a bit stressful. Dad was a shift worker who drank too much, I'm going to say. So
what did he do?
He worked at Nestle's factory. So, they used to make make dried milk, I think, and coffee. And, so he was a painter, like a house painter, when he was a young man. And then he, apparently was terrible at business. He was, too soft to actually, try to get money off people's houses he painted. So he ended up painting houses and then, not hassle them to pay him. So he wasn't a good businessman. So he ended up, getting a job in Nestle's factory and worked shift work for many years, which is very stressful for people. Shift workers are heroes, really, and it's they never have a normal life if they're working around the clock. So he was one of those guys. And, that made family life a bit stressful at times.
And your mum, she was a midwife.
Yeah, she worked as a nurse for many years. So, yeah, so they'd be juggling the four kids and, doing both working and, I mean, that was fine. It was fine.
How was it? Because obviously that is two full-on jobs. It's amazing jobs, but it is full-on. And like you said, you know, working shift work is, I mean, you've done breakfast radio, I've done breakfast radio, and that's not actually shift work, and that is full-on. You mentioned he drank heavily, and how was that? I mean, for the four kids, and especially when you were young.
Oh, it's just it's all we knew. I mean, mum will be annoyed about me talking about this, but, it was just, I think there was more drinking back then. I don't know, but, it's probably part of the reason that I don't drink is that, it can be stressful for the family, basically. So, big drinkers, are not the most stable, characters. You know, so, and, to go from highs to lows and, that can be stressful on children, basically. So, yeah, but, you know, it's what we knew and, it's the way it was.
Did you have a good relationship with your parents growing up?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I mean, it was with my mum. I did. Absolutely. And my dad there was fractious. I think there's a word that can be used as we got into became a teenager. So, I think that happens a lot with, dads and their sons that they, see the world differently. And I remember I would have been a pain in the ass as well. I mean, I remember once I read that Nestle were, selling baby formula to third world countries and, babies were getting sick. And so I got on my high horse and said that to dad, like, he works for a company that's, has no morals, basically. And he's like, shut up, mate. You know, that company is, you know, fed you for the last 18 years or whatever, 15 years. Don't tell me how to live. So I can imagine that that would have been annoying for him. So, yeah. But I mean, look, as I got older and I appreciated, you know, the struggle that my parents had. And I think many children, as they get older, appreciate the pressures that their parents were under, because you get under the same pressures yourself. So, and you realize that, you know, no one's perfect. And, you know, I think you forgive things that might have happened, you know, as you get older, which is good.
Well, that's it. I think someone once said to me, that you're just doing the best that you can. And I suppose in any situation growing up, your parents only know what they know at the time. So even though you can grow up as an adult saying, I wish they did this and did that, but we're all just doing the best that we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And my dad used to put pressure on me and call me lazy, and I was. So, you know, and I knew he wanted me to do as well as I could. And he was very wise in many ways, actually. So, I appreciate that more as I get older. So, yeah. So, yeah, that's, I mean, one thing though with my children, I just want them to have that sense of fun and not lose that and not take life too seriously. And that's really, I want to be able to laugh with my children, you know, all the time. And I think that's happening, which I'm really happy about.
Yeah. Well, they're pretty lucky, aren't they? They've got the perfect dad for that. How were the school years for you?
I was, a good student. So I was, you know, a smart kid. And yeah, it was probably, I didn't study as hard as I could have. There was times where, you know, that I was called in, my mum was called in with me to, for the, you know, for students, teachers to go, this kid could actually do well if he put his mind to it. So, you know, the teachers saw my potential and, look, I ended up, you know, getting the best marks in my, my year level. But as I've said many times, it was the worst year in the school's history. So I was the best of a bad lot at the Christian Brothers College. I was disappointed with my results because at the time it was like 1988 and LA Law was a TV show that was on involving glamorous lawyers who all had, great lives. And I was watching that TV show and thought, I want to be a lawyer so I could be one of those guys. And I didn't get enough marks to get into law that year. And so when I found out I got the best marks for the year level and I still couldn't get into law, I thought, well, maybe, I don't know. I didn't know how to feel, to be honest. So it was a bad year.
Once you finished school, you then moved to Melbourne, but you did an IT course for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, 1989 it was. IT was my cutoff. The score I got, the course that was, you know, right on the cutoff for me was IT and information technology. Back in 1989 was a new course. I mean, the internet really started about 1990. So, yeah, I was there. I got a scholarship to do it. So I was getting paid to be there. And that was part of my rebelliousness. Like, I don't want my parents to have to pay for me to go to university. So I'll do this scholarship. And, and it was computer coding and stuff, but I just couldn't be bothered. I had no interest in it. And you know what? I was homesick too. I mean, Melbourne, big city. I grew up in a small town, a rural town of 25,000 people. And so I could not handle the big city, didn't have the confidence to get to know people, was shy. And I ended up quitting after six. I quit just before I had to pay HECS. It was, was it 6 or 8 weeks? If you went past that time, then you had to pay that semester's HECS, and I didn't want to pay it. So I quit and went home. So, and worked in an abattoir actually for the year.
Yeah.
Oh, an abattoir is, that's a harsh place to work, I tell you. An abattoir.
What were you doing there?
I didn't want to be there long term, so I never learned how to use the knives. So that, I used to run the sheep up the race I used to basically push them towards their fate, so to speak. And I used to talk to the sheep. I used to be very gentle with the sheep, and people would look at me like I was insane. But, you know, I'd like to think those sheep had some nice moments just before they had their throats slit, basically.
Do you think that had any long-term effects?
Oh, look, it made me want to make something else in my life. Possibly. I haven't really thought about it. It was, I mean, I don't eat meat now, so yeah. maybe it had something to do with that. Yeah. So, I mean, There remains to an end in abattoir. So, and, you know, I do sometimes when people bang on about, oh, you know, every couple of years, Four Corners will do an expose on an Indonesian abattoir and like, oh no, how could they do that to those animals? And that's an abattoir, whether it's in Indonesia or in Australia. Mm. I mean, they're not fun places. And, you know, the animals suffer. They do. That's, you know, and that's, they do, they suffer because we want to eat them. So, you know, so. And that's what people should know when they eat meat, that, you know, they're part of that. But, you know, that also annoys people in my hometown who make a living out of it as well. So. Yeah.
And then you got into drinking yourself.
I was drinking from about 15 or 14 yeah. or 15, and I used to think it made me look cool. I was insecure and, you know, and yeah, I always drank too much. So I always got too drunk. And, look, I reckon it's in the genes. I think it gets passed on through your DNA.
Watching your dad do that as well. You know, I know as much as you didn't like that, that was what you grew up seeing.
Well, maybe, yeah. Or is it just literally, is it genetic? I don't know. I think sometimes it just gets passed on, as I said, through the genes. I don't know. I'm no expert, but yeah, I was always getting too drunk. I was never aggressive, but I was always hopeless and I would, you know, black out all the time and, you know, end up in the police cells. Not that often, but often enough that it was concerning. And, yeah, so I remember once I was working at the local, Warrnambool show, and probably at the age of 18, I was selling a Bart Simpson, dolls at the show, right? And I got into it. I was the people walking past, and I was starting, maybe my showbiz flair was starting to come out, and I was starting to really spruik it. I mean, who wants to buy these Bart Simpson dolls? And, God, The Simpsons been around a long time, hasn't it? Anyway, and this woman said to me, a young woman said, I can't believe you can speak. I said, what are you talking about? She said, I see you out every single weekend and you never are able to speak. I said, what do you mean? She said, you just can't speak. You're that drunk that you can't speak. I said, really? Do I get that drunk every weekend? I didn't even realize. So anyway.
Well, that's a wake up call if you've ever needed one. But obviously, because you used to binge drink quite a bit, and you used to smoke a bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't discover marijuana until I was 18. So, yeah. But that was like discovering, you know, Santa Claus for the first time. That was initially that is something that was wonderful, but then the paranoia crept in pretty quickly for me. Maybe a year in, I was like. Oh, it was, yeah. So I went through a period of quitting marijuana. I quit marijuana, cigarettes and alcohol, I think all within 3 months, but when I was 21, just before I turned 22. And, yeah, so I just went bang, bang, bang. And then there I was completely sober. And yeah, I started to feel better, you know, like mentally I started to get some control back. And yeah, so here I am now. I'm 49 and haven't touched either three in the last, 27 years.
But what? I mean, 21 is so young. That's when a lot of people start to get into that stuff. Yeah. But you were quitting everything. What was that pinnacle moment in all of those different kind of devices that you were having that made you stop?
I felt depressed. I just felt bad. I felt sad and I was not... I didn't feel in control of my mind, honestly. It was like I did feel like I'd given control over to these other things, and I wanted to get it sounds like an AA meeting now, but I wanted to get the power back. Mm. And you know, and once I did stop those things, I did get the power back. I mean, the highs weren't as high, obviously, but the lows were nowhere near as low. And you know, I started to feel good about myself, and yeah, so because I was pretty low when I was, you know. By the end of that time, I'd quit university. I actually went back after the work in the abattoir and did a business degree at the Deakin University in Warrnambool. And I was like, I got 18 months through that. And then I was so stoned all the time and that I just failed everything and quit that as well. So there I was, not working at all, not studying at all, just on the dole basically, and just stoned every day. And I felt terrible. And, so that's when I turned it around basically. I said, I don't want to feel like this anymore.
And then your life completely shifted. You moved to Perth.
I was doing like labouring jobs. I was doing anything to make some money. I was still on the dole at the time, but I would just cash in hand jobs. I went over there with the thought of doing stand-up comedy. I actually went, as I was failing my last business degree exam, like I knew I was going to get zero on the test. I distinctly remember thinking, you know, I want to be a comedian anyway. And so, and that memory stays with me to this day, that there I am failing university, thinking I want to be a comedian. No one, I'd never told anyone else I wanted to be a comedian, but I thought I did. And yeah, so when I went to Perth a few months later, I started doing stand-up comedy in Perth.
Obviously, wanting to be a comedian, you must have been making people laugh the whole time.
Not all the time, but I was. if I could get on stage, like, you know, if I won a trophy at footy or something, and I'd get on stage and there I'm accepting my trophy or whatever, I was able to make the audience laugh. Mm. I just, for whatever reason, get me in front of a group of people and I could make them laugh. I wasn't the life of the party off stage, really, unless I was drunk, but on stage I was. And so when, you know, if I did a speech, in, like, I remember doing a religious education speech one day in year 10, and I hadn't prepared the speech, but I just started improvising about a woman who might be a saint one day. I'll never forget her name. Sally Trench is her name. I think she looked after the homeless people in England back in the 60s or something. And I was able to make this class full of boys lose their minds with laughter. And the Christian brother who was in charge of the class hated me so much for it that he failed me in that subject. It was year 11 RE, and it's the only subject I failed in my secondary school life. But that was that one speech in year 11 where I made that whole class laugh, and the class had, they would score every speech, and I got perfect 10s from the class, even though he still failed me for the subject. That was the moment, I reckon, that lit the fire under my comedy career. I thought, you know what? This is intoxicating. So yeah.
And you know what? I would put money on that not one person in that class has not forgotten that speech either. Like, I would say that was a pinnacle moment for you and for them.
I'm in the WhatsApp group with some of those guys still to this day. And yes, we were talking about the other day, in fact. So
what was your first stand-up gig? How was that like?
That was in Perth. You know, the only times I'd been on stage to be funny was probably a few classes during school, but nothing official. I'd done a couple of mates' 21st speeches, and I'd torn up the room there as well. So, but doing stand-up comedy in a room, which is a stand-up comedy room, where that is so much pressure. There I was in Perth. I'd failed university. I was like, I'd put all my chips on this crazy comedy dream. And the first night I walked on stage, I was so nervous, and I had not prepared jokes, and certainly not well enough. And I got absolutely no laughs, and it was like I was telling those people that I was a loser. It was humiliating, and the room didn't have, there was no backstage, so you had to walk through the room once you'd finished on stage, and oh God, it was a long walk. There was probably only 60 people there, but that was the worst moment of my life. It was so bad.
And what made you want to get up again and start doing it? Yeah.
Well, you know what? I actually thought, and I was humiliated, and you know, I was living with it. I was in Perth living with another guy from Warrnambool at the time, Rat Day, good mate of mine to this day. And I got back to the little flat that we were renting, and he said, "How did you go?" And I said, "Not very good." And he said, "You know why?" And I said, "Oh, not really." And he looked at me and said, "Because you're not funny." Now, me and Rat are still good mates, but that was a brutal assessment of what I was doing. But, you know, and I was so humiliated, but I thought, if I don't go the next week and try to do it again, I will never do it ever. So I summoned up the courage and went back to that same comedy venue a week later and got back on stage. And I didn't get many laughs, but I kept my composure, something I hadn't done the first week. And the second week, what I talked about was the fact that I'd been so unfunny the first week. And that's when I probably realized that in your failure is the seeds of your success. Because when you can see your failure as funny, well, then you can't be defeated. So yeah, it was fine. But then I still didn't do it again for 6 months, or maybe 3 months. I can't remember how long, because I was so, my mind was so addled by those two experiences. But maybe it was 3 months later, I saw an ad in the local West Australian newspaper that said new comics required. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to have another go. And I rang the number, and it was, I didn't know at the time, but it was the same venue looking for new comics.
Wow.
And the guy who answered the phone said, I remember you from when you tried it before. You weren't that bad. You should have another go. So he said that to me, and I said, yeah, right. All right. I wasn't that bad. And I went back, booked in, got back on stage, and it was the third gig I ever did. As I was walking on stage, something just occurred to me. You're a winner for just doing this. You're already a winner. And it was that thought just relaxed me as I walked on stage. And the laughs I got in that third ever gig, I'm probably only up there for 5 minutes, but the laughs I got stay with me to this day. I'm still trying to chase those laughs. It was the high. I've never had a high like it before or
really?
Since. There was that moment where the whole room is laughing and then I realized, yes, you're right. This is what you're meant to do. And it was the joy of that was just, I'm getting tingles just thinking about it now. It was just the joy of, yes, this is it. You're not a deluded loser who's going to be on the dole forever. You know, this is where you're meant to be. And it was so powerful.
Isn't that amazing that to this day that you still can remember that and you still remember the feeling that you felt at that time, because feelings are so powerful. They're more powerful than words.
Yeah, it was. I floated off that stage and I was just, you know, again, it was like 50 people in a room, didn't get paid. It was like 5 minutes, you know, but I was just on such a high that I knew. And since that day, so that was, since that day, I've been doing stand-up comedy every single week for the last, what is it? That's 1990. It was 93, I reckon. So it's the last 26 years or 27 years.
And something else that you did, which I think is just so unbelievable, is you started writing affirmations. You used to write affirmations to yourself in your diary, and you wrote things like, I'm never going to stop having a go, have the right attitude, live each moment as it comes, be free from guilt, and the most important one, which is laugh. What made you even think to write those?
You know, I actually started probably back in the time where I was depressed and still probably smoking marijuana and drinking too much. I discovered, you know, self-help books, to be honest. There was a guy actually called, he probably still writes books, I don't know, Wayne Dyer, Dr. Wayne Dyer.
I love him.
Oh, really?
He actually passed away a few years ago.
But did he?
Yeah. He is like one of the biggest spiritual teachers that has affected my life.
Yeah, well, there you go. I feel bad that he's passed away, and I obviously lost touch with what he did, but his some of his early books really helped me so much. I mean, you know, and I remember being at home back in Warrnambool on the dole and, you know, still not achieving anything and reading his books. And I remember people, maybe even my parents just going, what are you reading? I said, this guy really he speaks to me. So yeah, it's funny that you are also affected by him.
He, I think, is one of the absolute kings of the, like, you know, metaphysical kind of spiritual world. And his old books, which I assume are the ones that you read that I've
You'll
read
see it
recently,
when you believe it.
Yeah, yeah. They've absolutely touched me. I mean, those learnings now are so useful for today. It's nothing has changed. You know, he's so unbelievably powerful. How did you even get onto his stuff?
I don't know. I was probably, you know what, I was probably just wandering around again, unemployed, and walked into a bookshop and just saw a book. You know, I can't remember how I got onto it, but I definitely, it resonated with me. And it's just, you know, it's trying to tell my children as well that you produce your thoughts. Mm. No one else produces them. They're your thoughts, and you're churning them out, and it's your decision. You're making the decision. We're all making our decisions on our attitude, and we're making decisions on how we feel, you know? So, and it came from guys like
yeah.
that yeah, who, yeah, really.
He's got this amazing quote. I don't know if you've heard it before, and it's, I think about it every day, and especially when I get into a situation that, you know, maybe is not one that I really want to be in. He says, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
Yeah. Attitude is, yeah, I mean, I read a number of his books, but what I used to say to myself all the time, actually, and I can't remember whether I read this or I made this up, is when you're happy, happy things happen, you know, decide to be happy first, and then things around you will happen, you know, they will happen, happy things will happen, but they also, you add to that, well, it doesn't matter whether they don't or not because you're happy.
Well, that's it. Exactly.
So it doesn't matter what happens, you're already happy. So you actually decide to be happy. And for me, that was part of the reason to give up alcohol and drugs, is that if I'm going to be happy, I'm going to make myself happy. Nothing else has to make me happy. I make myself happy. And now drugs, alcohol, nothing, they don't give other things the power to make your mood good. You decide yourself that your mood's going to be good. So,
Well, that's it. And you look at your life since you finished that, it's absolutely flourished. You then went on to do something which kind of changed things forever. You did an appearance on Hey Hey It's Saturday. How was that, and how did that affect your career moving forward?
That, again, probably the most nervous I've ever been, apart from the first stand-up comedy gigs. Actually, no, more nervous than that was, going on Hey Hey It's Saturday back in about 97. So it's a TV show that I grew up watching, in a small country town. Well, not that small, but, and it was every Saturday night, everyone would sit down and, after you turn 18, you'd still turn it on at 6:30 and watch that before you went out, to get drunk basically. So to walk onto that stage, they had a segment called, Red Faces back in the day where amateurs would go on the show, and I'd already been doing stand-up comedy, and I moved to Melbourne after being in Perth for about almost 2 years. I moved to Melbourne to further my stand-up comedy career, and I auditioned for Red Faces twice, actually trying to, as an amateur, just get on and be funny, and the guy rejected me twice. He just would not remember the second time. He didn't even look up from his clipboard, and I'm doing a routine in front of one guy, and he's not even looking at me. I actually said to him, mate, can you just look at me? And the security guard walked me out. He said, whatever. And the security guard walked me out. So I think they thought I was going to get aggressive, like physically aggressive with him. So I couldn't get on the Red Faces, the amateur, segment, but I was able to get on as a stand-up comedian, like as a professional, not long afterwards. I remember walking past the same guy, Jack Strom or something. Anyway, we've since made up about what happened back then, but, and I was trying to get him to look at me, trying to get him to remember me. Yeah, I'm the guy you rejected. I'm the guy you got the security guard to walk out of the building. Here I am. But, he didn't even look up again, so he couldn't even remember. But anyway. But I was so nervous, but it went well, went really well. And the gig, the routine I did was about being on the dole, which again was part of my attitude. Bad things happen to you. You turn them into jokes and you become a winner. And, everyone who's on the dole gets embarrassed. There'll be a lot of people right now, whenever I can on radio or whatever, I say, don't be embarrassed about being on the dole. I was on the dole for 7 years. it can be part of life. But it's still embarrassing. If you're at a party and someone says, what do you do? You don't want to say you're unemployed. So it was embarrassing.
Yes, of course.
But I developed a routine about being on the dole, and it was funny as, and people used to love it. And I did it on Hey at Saturday, and it went really well. And, that was another real high for me. So yeah, that was the first time on national TV, and it was a real win for me. And,
And you wrote something that was so beautiful in your diary, which I loved. You say, I don't tell jokes, I tell stories. Take us through that.
Well, I mean, what I want to do is like use my own life and see the funny in that, so that's, and people would, over the years I'd say, well, are you going to run out of material? And I'm like, no, I won't, because life will always be funny, and it always has been, no matter where I'm at in life, it's funny, whether you're on the dole without a girlfriend or, you're talking about, obviously I've done really well, I've got a beautiful family, there's jokes everywhere. So, it's just about being able to see the funny. It's there. You just have to see it, and then And the more honest you can be in your material, I think the more more it resonates with people. So, what you want people to say when they come and see me or they hear me on the radio is that I can relate to that. I can tell there's an honesty in what you're doing, and that's what you want. That's what I want, and I'm happy when people realize that.
And in 2001, you began doing your fabulous breakfast radio with Kate Langbrook, and your life just changed dramatically from there. How was that run?
The fame started to kick in from there, I suppose. I mean, fame in Australia at least. It was, I always enjoyed radio as well. And for me, it's an extension of stand-up comedy where I still, to this day, just think that I get on the radio and talk about my life and people relate and laugh and, you know, and I get paid for it. And I've been doing it for a long time. And, yeah, but it was every day. The discipline of every day, of getting up every day, being able to have to do radio was it took a little while to get used to, because when you're just doing stand-up comedy, you are – you know, you're sleeping in a lot. And but I did. I loved it straight away, and it connected with a lot of people straight away. And, you know, it's been going for a long time now.
You mentioned before, like, obviously that was, you know, you're into then becoming a celebrity in the entertainment industry. And then there are a lot of egos in the entertainment industry, which comes with that, you know, notoriety. How do you manage yours?
Yeah, the only thing that, you know, the ego is, my own ego is what's the only thing that's caused me pain really over my whole career. And it's like, again, it's just, it's ridiculous where, I remember at one stage I went through thinking about, oh God, you know, I'm not as popular as I used to be, or, you know, I sold more tickets last year, or, you know, that sort of stuff. And it's ridiculous. Honestly, we've all got to live in the moment no matter what we're doing. You've got, living in the moment is the only way to go. It's, you cannot hang on to the past, or like I'd get a bad review and then I'd stress over that someone didn't think I was funny. Oh, look, I still do it to a degree, but I think I'm a lot better than I used to be of just letting it go and realizing that it is all temporary. It's, you know, it's, none of us are going to be remembered in 100 years, or maybe, but certainly not in 200, you know, or maybe not in a year. I mean, it's stressing over your place in society or your pecking order in some sort of entertainment ladder is just ridiculous and gets you absolutely nowhere. So over the years, I've certainly got better at it. Absolutely. And one thing is, never hold a grudge. Mm. If you're holding a grudge against someone, you're not living in the present. You can't hold a grudge and live in the present. So hopefully I've realized just to let all past, my perception of someone slighting me or wronging me, I've let it go, thank God.
Well, it's liberating yourself when you do that as well. Even more so than, you know, letting the other person off the hook. It's about, you know, not living with that internal, anger.
Don't let someone else live inside your head, as you know. I didn't coin that phrase, but that's, you know, it's just ridiculous. You know, I'd stress about some review I got, you know, in the Adelaide Advertiser or something. Someone, you know, some real estate, a person who's just been shipped in to do a review turns up to your comedy show and gives you like a 2-star review or a 1-star review, and I get angry because they didn't mention that everyone was laughing. So.
The comedy is an industry where it is pretty full on like that. And, you know, to put yourself in front of people and then you're going on if they're laughing or not, it's hard to not care what they think. How do you manage that?
Oh, but when you don't care what people think is when you go best, you know. Mm. Like when I'm on stage, and, you know, I still go through periods of this, but I'm much better than I used to be. When I used to be more erratic, I think over the years, you hopefully get more consistent as to your attitude. But when I'm on stage and I'm in a good mood, I can look into the audience and see someone looking absolutely miserable. Like they're having the worst time of their lives. Like someone's dragged them, you know, at gunpoint to your show and they absolutely hate me. And I'd look in their face and see that and just laugh. Like that makes me laugh. It's someone hating me. It just makes me laugh. That's when I know I'm having a good gig, because I'm like, it is so, what I'm doing here is so silly and life is so silly that someone who hates me and I can see it through their eyes is making me laugh. So that's the attitude I want when I'm on stage, you know. But other times when I'm insecure, I'll look at a room full of people and, you know, 98% of them are laughing, and I'll look at that one person yawning and I'll feel terrible because they're And it's like they know that I'm not funny, you know. So, but my attitude to that person, not, and in every audience there's going to be people not laughing. My attitude to seeing that person not laughing is for me whether I'm in the right place or not. If I can look at them not laughing and be amused by that, well, then I'm bulletproof.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I'm going to think about that in my everyday life.
Yeah.
Tell me, not long ago, your dad actually passed away, and this is a beautiful story. You, on your TV show, you were talking about how, like, a lot of people's parents, dads in particular, they have never said a lot that they love them, and you mentioned that about your dad. And then later that evening, someone messaged you on Instagram, and it was a beautiful nurse that looked after your dad, Des, and she wrote this message to you. She wrote, "Hi, Dave. After watching the show, I nursed your dad at Mercy, and he loved his family so much. He would often speak of you as kids. You definitely have his humour. He was a real gentleman who was so proud of his kids."
Yeah, it was beautiful. I remember at the time it was just, I'm just getting a bit tingly now just hearing that back. So, yeah, that was a lovely message to get from a nurse who did nurse my dad as he moved to the next world. And yeah, for her to say that, yeah, he was a gentleman and that he was proud of his children was lovely. And it made me really emotional. And that was a beautiful moment.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, like, it is quite common that parents don't sometimes, you know, especially back in that era, say that they love their kids, even though with their full heart they would have, you know, given their life to their children, yet they hold it inside. How now, as a parent, has that made you be with your children, knowing that your dad never really said that to you?
Yeah, look, I mean, I hopefully am more expressive than my dad was, or, you know, than my, even my mum has trouble saying I love you. It's like a weird thing. We still have trouble saying, it's not, I mean, obviously she does and she's been so good to me, but those words are hard to say. It's like we get embarrassed. I think that, hopefully I will, me and my children will have a closer relationship, and, you know, that we'll not have the acrimony that can happen between, a father and son, or, you know, so, I don't know how I'll do that, but just keep, remembering that, you know, we've got to keep talking, basically. So even now, I mean, you've got to just speak to your family more often. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to ring mum more often than I have in the past. It's just like everyone's busy, and then all of a sudden the week or the month goes past and you haven't spoken to your own mother. It's just crazy. Got to do it more often.
Were you able to tell your dad that you loved him before he died?
Yeah, I was there on the night he died, which was, I was able to. I mean, that was luck more than anything for me. You know, at the time I was doing the project, so I was like full time on the TV show, The Project, and doing breakfast radio still. I was very busy at the time, and I still am. But yeah, I was down in Warrnambool on the night that he passed. So that was I was lucky, basically, to be there at the end. He got dementia towards the end. It was quick in the end. I mean, it's a tough thing to say, but yeah, it's when you see someone with dementia, it's like, oh, they're hard places to visit, you know, those sort of nursing homes. And it's, Dad didn't hang around for long, but, look, he was a very wise man in many ways, and, you know, and he was always about family, and, you know, and you forget that, and he was not someone who was ever really worried about money at all, but he was just, you know, as long as you got enough to live. So he was a very smart man, no doubt. And he was someone connected to just the simple things in life. So, you know, there was much wisdom to be gained from my father. And,
And you are probably one of the hardest workers in the Australian entertainment industry, and have been for years, and everything you have in your life, you have because you've been able to achieve all these amazing things. Where did you get that work ethic from?
Look, I, again, that was, it would surprise people because I wasn't, you know, I was, I remember I did one day of a paper round as a, like a 14 year old and just thought, I don't want to get up early and just quit after one day. So it's like, so I was not someone, you know, I was like, I didn't want to do chores around the backyard, even though there was money in it for me. And so I was lazy in many ways. But I think it's the love of comedy. I've just got to, I found something I loved, you know, and it's, and it, I suppose possibly, stopping, you know, alcohol and drugs and stuff. So the adrenaline rush I get from comedy is that's my jam. That's my thrill. And I just bloody love it, you know, and I don't care what it is. I'll turn up to this day. I'll turn up to some of the dodgiest gigs and people go, why are you here? I'm like, I just love it. I love it. And obviously financially, I don't need to be there at all. I don't need to, depending on how the stock market goes over the next few months, I possibly don't have to work again. But, you know, I absolutely love it and I'll still do it for free. It's the thrill of, and the joy of getting a laugh is something that I'll love for the, I'll be in a nursing home one day, you know, trying to organize gigs in the rec room. There's no doubt.
I hope we're in the same nursing home. When you reflect back at your life and all the things that you've done and you've achieved, what are you most proud of?
Oh, look, I, as a comedian, I was so proud when I was, I still remember the first time I got paid to make people laugh. That was just amazing. I mean, I've been, you know, it might have been $50 or $100 or something. I was like, I've got this money for making people laugh. It was just, that was remarkable to me. And when I was able to make a living out of it, you know, finally get off the dole, that was another achievement for me. It's like, I'm able to, you know, make a proper living as someone who, you know, entertains people. Mm. And so, yeah, and from that, there's, you know, there's been many highs in my comedy life and, you know, but it's hard to rank them and I don't really even, you don't really reflect on it anymore. It's just like, it's not worth it. I remember once, you know, I did the Montreal Comedy Festival once and got a standing ovation and it was like, oh, my God, here I am in Montreal, you know. Look, I'm not a name in any other part of the world, I know that, but, you know, here I was with, it was called All Stars Comedians and there was other really well-known North American comedians on the bill and no one knew me, but I did my spot, you know, coming off nothing, there was no history for them people to think I was funny and they laughed so much they gave me a standing ovation at the end of it and it was like, that was a real high for me. But, you know what, I went back there I think the next year and all I could think about was the standing ovation I got last time and then I was like, as I'm doing the gig again at the Montreal, there's 3,000 people there and I'm doing, you know, I'm doing well, but in my head I'm thinking they're not going to stand. This isn't as good as last time and they're not going to stand and they didn't stand and I'm like, I walked off stage really unhappy. You know why? Because I wasn't living in the moment. Yes. I was trying to hold on to a past glory. It was just ridiculous. And again, a lesson in doesn't matter what's happened in the past. Just enjoy the moment you're in.
Well, so, that's it. It's so unbelievably important. Mm-hmm. What's your greatest hope for society today?
Well, my only hope is that people don't take themselves too seriously. All I want my children to do and all I want to do is open my eyes and be amazed that I'm alive, be amazed that we're on this planet. You know, almost all of us take for granted the fact that we can breathe or we can see or we can touch or we can think. It's just, being alive is an incredible mystery that we all should be in awe of pretty much the whole time. So, yeah, that's what I would want, that more people can just be just blown away by the fact that they're actually alive.
What's the lesson that took you the longest to learn?
Again, I reckon probably that is that of just, and I'm still learning it, it's just stay in the moment, you know, stay in the moment. And like, again, I do radio surveys, I get weekly TV ratings and, you know, and you're sad because you're looking at people who aren't watching you rather than the people who are watching you, you know. I always say to myself, at any moment, life could be over. You don't know when, you know, a tree's going to fall on you or you're going to, whatever. We don't know when. It's going to happen one day. We don't know when. I don't want that last moment to be when I'm miserable because my radio ratings weren't good enough or my TV ratings weren't good enough. I didn't sell enough tickets that day, you know, stand-up show. I want my last moment to be me looking around going, my God, being alive is incredible.
Do you pray at all?
I don't. No, I don't. I mean, I grew up a Catholic. I don't. Like, I'm not a... No, I don't. But I, for me, it's that the silence, I think, was trying to find the silence.
Mm.
In the silence is the... that's where the... whatever it is, and I don't know what it is, but that's where...
The next
level,
is,
yeah, the next level is in that silence where you just, wow, the awe and the majesty of life itself is in that silence. And, you know, I don't know what's next. I know there's something next. So I know this is not it, but I don't know what it is. But yeah, it's, but again, the miracle is in every moment. Every moment is an absolute miracle.
What is a life of greatness to you?
It's just, it's looking out at the ocean and realizing the wonder of life. It's looking up at the stars and realizing how amazing it is to be on this planet. I think really that's the people who I'm most in awe of are the people who most often do that, who just see the awe in every moment. They're the richest people.
Dave Hughes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers Matt Nikolich and Darcy Thompson. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now, and listen for free.
Listener.